Hello, listeners. This is part one of The Vanishing Season by Katie Darby, read by Katie Darby. And for atmosphere's sake, I've also managed to get a virtual fireplace and wind noises on my computer. So just for that true M.R. James feeling. You'll have to imagine, if you will, that I'm a sort of mid-20s Victorian graduate, undergraduate, at Cambridge in 1892, and you'll also have to forgive my Suffolk accent in this particular section. Here goes. It happened in the long and arid summer of 1892, when weeks of unrelieved sun had beaten the grass of the Cambridgeshire fields tough and tawny, and even the shaded emerald velvet courts visible from the King's College Library windows were tanning about the edges. Indolent and restless as a dog in those endless July days, kennelled by my books, I was both surprised and delighted when I received an invitation from my old friend, Chester Whittingstall. That fatal invitation. I ought to have burned it. It had called to me as a siren. How could he have known the doom it would bring? Whittingstall had come up several years before myself, and because he was a connection of my cousin Edgar's, I was introduced to him as a matter of course. Though he was pursuing his doctorate in divinity, and I was a mere undergraduate in history, when we fell into conversation we nonetheless discovered much in common, especially our mutual, unfashionable interest in ecclesiastical art. Thus we made time to strengthen our casually formed acquaintance, fortifying it over port and pedantry until it was a bond something less than that of brothers, but more than mere friends. Whittingstall was virtually the only fellow I'd met whose particularities, pastimes, and penchants chimed so nearly with my own that we would often find ourselves quoting the same sage or reading the same book entirely by coincidence. Imagine, if you will, on this rain-washed night, the tedium of the long vac made longer by afternoons in the library nodding over fragile tomes, for the stultifying heat made it impossible to venture abroad between 10 and 3. Think what it is to be among the dozen men left in college, none of whom one knows nor cares to, and the consequently strained silent dinners in hall, perspiring beneath the hot, heavy yoke of a scholar's gown. Conjure to your mind's ear the drone of heat-drunk flies buffeting the window glass as one lies sweltering and sheetless, vainly courting sleep, and you will, I suspect, better understand quite how much of a yearned-for escape, not to mention an intriguing mystery, Whittingstall's sudden overture presented. Yet, while I was delighted to hear from a bosom friend whose lack I had so keenly felt, I was puzzled too. We had quarrelled over a rather foolish matter just before he left the university, and our estrangement had wrenched at me ever since, though never quite enough to bring me to end it. What, then, had compelled him to break the silence between us? I could not guess the reason, but with what profound pleasure I looked forward to a reunion with my comrade. Perhaps I ought to seize this opportunity to paint a brief portrait in miniature of my remarkable friend. With the reader's indulgence, I will do so, that you may picture him as clearly as I, after long absence, then did. Whittingstall was a clever, cheerful, fresh-faced fellow, somewhat under the middle height and inclining to portliness, with bright brown eyes and a head of wild dark curls, which were the only thing about him not absolutely neat and squared away. He was always immaculately elegant and modest in his dress, extremely precise in his tastes, and regular in his habits. He once told me that he had not breakfasted on anything other than toast and marmalade, a single boiled egg, and 2 cups of well-brewed Assam tea for the last decade. Our shared fastidiousness, so markedly different from the common run of students, was another thing which drew us together as kindred spirits. However, he was by no measure dull. Whittingstall's brilliance of mind was complemented by a fiercely burning belief in both Darwin's much-contested ideas on evolution and the precept held by the Bible that man was the natural pinnacle of God's creation. In his person and his personality, he was one of the few men I have ever met who managed successfully to reconcile a profound respect for science and what he called the cool, dry fact with a sincere, intelligent religiosity. Of course, at that time, in my own innocence, I did not find the notion of man as a product of both God and nature, at once brutal and divine, as irreconcilable a conundrum as it subsequently became when the dreadful events I will narrate shook my faith in all that I ever held to be true. But I am anticipating my own story, and must tell everything as it happened in its own proper sequence. Rationality and reason are their own reward. Or so, once, I thought. When, shortly after taking holy orders, Whittingstall was offered the living of St. Peter's in the tiny, ancient village of Weniston in the easternmost wilds of Suffolk, I admit to feeling some astonishment that he at once accepted. I had expected him to hold out for some larger, more populous parish which might put his considerable charisma and rhetorical talents to better use. But, as he told Cousin Edgar with a smile, the church had been without a vicar for some time, and I am bound to bring light where there is most darkness. Weniston, I thought privately at the time, sounded obscure enough in every sense to satisfy even Chester's missionary zeal. I collected his letter one glaring noon, the short walk in the already merciless heat enervating me utterly, from my pigeonhole in the lodge, where the disapproving porter informed me it had been languishing some days. Recognising the hand with a start, I anticipated some sort of overture to reconciliation. Yet he opened the dispatch in his usual amusing, offhand style, quite as though a rift had never rent us, and made no reference to the matter which had, until that moment, cast our friendship adrift. Instead, he launched into an offhand pencil portrait of his village. It seemed that, if anything, I had overestimated the size and sophistication of Weniston. Most places, however small, if they boast but one church, will have two or three times that number of public houses serving the community, and that community will likely comprise 100 or 200 souls. Yet, according to my count, there is a single inn, the Star, and barely 40 parishioners, many of whose faces I do not see from Sunday to Sunday. The land twixt us and Blythburgh is, my verger assures me, famous county-wide for its pig farming, he wrote ironically, though less so for its social calendar. But the burden of his missive was not to do with the shortcomings of this otherwise charming village. Indeed, he hardly mentioned the place after this wry introduction, to give you fair warning, old fellow, of what you may be getting into. Instead, the bulk of the pages were devoted entirely to a new and extraordinary discovery lately made in his very own church. A rare and exceptionally well-preserved Doom painting. It had lain unsuspected beneath the whitewashed chancel arch, and only been uncovered by the luckiest accident when sorely overdue restoration work was finally commenced. It seemed that the local men undertaking the job, rough labourers all, headed by a carpenter from the nearby village of Blackheath, had removed the wooden tympanum crowning the arch with the intention of reusing the oaken planks or burning them if they proved too rotten. However, as the day grew old and the light failed, the workers, bethinking themselves, no doubt, of their cooling dinners, had left the panels scattered about the graveyard, instead of stacking them neatly in the church porch as instructed. Overnight rain, the first the county had enjoyed for weeks, had partly revealed the astonishing secret of these blank boards quite by chance. Sluiced away by a torrential storm, a 400-year-old whitewash proved to conceal a painting of exquisite workmanship, depicting the Last Judgment, or Doomsday. On stepping outside the next morning into the newly moist, grass-scented air to perambulate the churchyard, as was his custom after breakfast, Chester had been confronted with what he at first thought could only be a vision. Rosy-winged angels and horned hirsute devils reared between the cockeyed, moss-grown gravestones. In the shadow of the yew, a wood pigeon strutting pompously before him, St. Michael held a great golden balance in which he weighed a sinner's soul. But most strikingly of all, there, caught in a shaft of early sunshine, was Christ himself, red-robed with his hands raised in benediction, sitting atop a rainbow. "It was incongruous," wrote Whittingstall. "It was exquisite. It was impossible. Yet there sat the doom, quite as fresh as the day it was painted. In pieces, yes, but wonderfully complete." By the style, the colour palette, and sundry other unmistakable features, it was at once clear to my expert friend that this masterpiece, I think I may call it that, had been completed at some point between 1500 and 1520, mere decades before the Reformation obliged the whitewashing of images, which accounted for its uniquely pristine condition. "It is a miracle," his letter assured me, in writing which wavered a little with passion or disbelief, "or as close to one as I have ever seen. If it had not rained, if the panels had been placed inside as they ought, if I had not been the one to see them first, it makes me weep almost at God's beneficence. I shudder to think, but for the providence of all these things, what might have been lost? So much else from that turbulent period has." He went on to describe the divine panorama. "Briefly, that you may guard your virgin wonder for when you first see it and feel what I felt," and begged me to do him the honour of visiting him to view the piece, "not only for my pleasure and gratification, but for your own. And I should be most interested in your thoughts on certain unusual details within the painting, too." These he left unspecified, perhaps intending to discuss them with me in person upon my arrival. "Alas," he lamented, "the rood cross, St. John, and Mary the Mother are missing. I suspect that they were carved in relief and affixed separately, and thus perhaps removed to some other part of the church when the panel was painted over. I fear it all too likely that they, like the angels which once adorned St. Peter's roof beams, would have been destroyed by Cranmer's purging hordes in the 1540s. But, these losses aside, the doom itself is near perfect." He knew it would tempt me, and in truth I ached to see it. History and art had long vied for the nearest place to my heart, and here were both in one irresistible parcel. "It is truly a marvellous thing. One of the best I have ever seen, Emerson. I know now why I was called to this little place. I know at last that it was God's will that I should be here at this wondrous moment. For if I had not instantly recognised it for what it was, who knows whether the indifferent workman might not yet have tossed it to feed the flames?" My luncheon chop grew hard and gelid, my coffee cold, and the golden eye of the egg gleaming uneaten upon my plate dulled like that of a dying fish, as I read through Chester's entire 10-page letter. By the time I had finished, a waiter was whisking crumbs meaningfully from the place beside mine. The sun had passed far enough over the meridian to strike golden beams into my eyes through the high hall windows. And I had made up my mind to leave Cambridge that very hour for the sleepy Suffolk hamlet of Wenniston. Another characteristic which Whittingstall and I shared, was that when we made up our mind to do something, that action was immediately performed. No sooner had I resolved upon my course than I hastened straight back to my room, mounting the worn stone steps two at a time, and packed a small, stout valise with the necessary accoutrements of a brief sojourn in the countryside. In went my lightest shirts and suits of clothes, my shaving kit, a trivial book I was currently enjoying, and another, more scholarly tome, which I felt I ought to, and a small guide to ecclesiastical art I snatched up on a whim. The Tudor period was my particular specialism, and I had been toying idly for some months with the notion of authoring a monograph upon the representations of St. Michael. My attention had been caught by Whittingstall's offhand revelation that the Doom's Michael, usually so militant, was for once unarmoured, instead robed in white and caped in red. Perhaps, I thought, as I strapped shut my case, this was a sign to me to begin my work in earnest, for I had an itch to write more than just essays before my time at Cambridge was over. This, indeed, was some of the reason I had stayed up for the long vac rather than returning home to Hampshire to endure the tedious round of whist parties, dinners, and riding with what passed for local society. I sincerely regret now my taking this serendipitous adventure so casually and, yes, selfishly, I think, considering only what amusement and inspiration it might provide me, rather than the significance of such a discovery to both the wider world and, most particularly, my friend. Nonetheless, I left the baking, deserted streets of Cambridge with a thrill in my breast and nary a backward glance. Not 2 days would pass before I would wish myself with all my heart back in my cramped yet cosy quarters at King's. Would wish I had never left their fusty, familiar safety, and that I had never heard of the Woodwose, nor the cursed Weniston Doom. Having wired Whittingstall from the station that I should give myself the pleasure of arriving today, I secured my seat in an otherwise empty smoking compartment on the next train east out of Cambridge. Settling onto the scorching leather, I lowered the window shade against the glaring eye of the sun and studied the timetable for the Southwold line, which would connect me to Weniston. For remote and unpopulous as it was, it nonetheless boasted both a railway station and a telegraph office, the station master performing both functions, no doubt, as in so many out-of-the-way places. Services were infrequent, but I calculated that if I changed at Halesworth, I could contrive to reach my destination a little before supper. I looked forward to catching up on my friend's less sensational news before he gave me a guided viewing of his spectacular find. Chester had said in his letter that though he could not decide whether one hand or several had created the masterpiece, he had perceived some local references in the painting itself which might help to identify the hitherto unknown artist or artists. I hoped he did not look to me for local knowledge, for though I had visited the odd Suffolk village in the idle pursuit of various historical interests, among them Mildenhall, Hartist and Dunwich, they were few and far enough between, and I could not claim to know the county better than any other casual shilling tripper. Broiling now, even in my lightweight summer linen, I raised the blind and lowered the carriage window, admitting some cooler air to the compartment, which had grown warm and stifling as a greenhouse beneath the sun's relentless assault. As I dropped back into my seat, mopping the perspiration from my temples with an already damp handkerchief, I glanced out at the country through which I was passing. The fields and cottages lay parched yellow in the afternoon dazzle, without breath nor motion, a photograph of themselves. It was as if the heat had dealt them a stunning blow which had somehow stilled time too. The only thing stirring in the whole halted landscape seemed to be my train, the only sound the magnified clockwork ticking of its wheels along the tracks. the present rushing headlong through the past, I mused to myself, fancifully enough, then fell into a heat-struck doze and thought no more of it. By the time I arrived at Wenniston Station, the long summer evening had just begun to wane, and with it my energy. Though not, I am glad to say, any eagerness to see both my old friend and his superb new treasure. Having ascertained with the station master, who was, as I had suspected, also custodian of the telegraph traffic, that my message with my proposed time of arrival would have reached the rectory of St. Peter's some hours since, I sat down to await my host. I found a mercifully shaded bench just without the building, and passed the time with my foolish little book of ghost stories, whose chill and tenebrous atmosphere contrasted pleasingly with the soporific warmth all about me. It was but a short distance to the church, but had I felt inclined to walk there, but as even a brief stroll in this weather seemed dangerously likely to bring on heatstroke, I resolved, like a piece of left luggage, to wait until called for. Eventually, an unpretentious gig drew up, from which descended an even less pretentious, evidently local fellow. So rustic he was actually chewing a straw when he stamped past into the station to roar my name. I leapt up, introducing myself and thanking him for his consideration in coming to convey me such a short distance, though of course it was Whittingstall's civility to which I owed this convenience. "No trouble, sir," he burred in an accent thick as butter, and led me back out to the gig where a patient chestnut mare was cropping the roadside thistles. Having seated ourselves, he flicked the whip. It transpired that his name was Oxborough, and he was the verger of St. Peter's. "Though he's a parcel of other duties besides," he added, grinning through teeth variously yellowed and absent. As we hopped down before the handsome old flint-built church in the last of the evening light, I remarked that I hoped my visit was not inconveniently sudden, explaining that the minute I read Whittingstall's letter I'd been seized with an urge to see the doom for myself, so vividly had he evoked it.
"I've been told to expect you, sir, so it weren't no surprise," said Oxborough, and frowned.
"But do you say the letter only come to you today?"
"I believe a day or two ago," I said. "I only collected it this morning, else I would have been here much earlier. Such a unique invitation brooks no delay, you know, for us fellows who care about this sort of thing."
My attempted pleasantry was as lost on him as on one of the rooks crowing in the yew above. "In any case," I continued as we stopped before the rectory's ancient black door, "I confess all this travelling has rather worked up my appetite, so if you wouldn't mind announcing my arrival to your master, we've a good deal to catch up on over dinner." At once he bristled like a hound, and his lip lifted in all but a snarl.
"Vicar ain't my master," he said sharply, "and he ain't going to meet you tonight."
I confess I was quite taken aback, both at the man's sudden hostility and at this truly unexpected lapse of courtesy in the punctilious Whittingstall. I could only assume some sudden indisposition had consigned him to his bed. "Oh!" I could not conceal my dismay. "Very well, if he is ill, I will dine alone, but perhaps I may look in on him come morning?"
"He ain't ill," came the stolid, unhelpful reply.
"Ah, well then, I don't quite see." Oxborough stared at me for a long moment, as though wondering whether to entrust me with the information he held. I might wish he never had, and yet I could not have turned back, even then. I should have found it out somehow, and I would never have been persuaded to leave the place under any circumstances without having seen and studied the Wenniston Doom. So perhaps our fate is sealed after all, like the little bottles in which they capture model ships, and we only delude ourselves that we are steering our own course.
"He's gone," said the verger abruptly. 2 days back, just the day after I posted that letter. But the housekeeper got your telegram this afternoon, so I come for you. I must have been gaping like a landed trout, for his expression softened. There's supper on the table, good not, but you won't find no company to eat it with. I was staggered. Chester. Gone. After finding such a treasure, after initiating our rapprochement solely to tell me of it, after inviting me here to see it? Gone, I echoed. Gone where? Oxborough merely shrugged sullen shoulders. Didn't say. Just set off Wednesday out of breakfast and ain't seen him since. Well, may I know when he is expected back, at least? The verger favoured me with a pitying look. He'll come back when he's ready, sir. Maybe not at all. Dear me! Have you not reported his absence to the police? I had been attempting to master my shock and surprise, but this was really too extraordinary. A smile creaked his lips upward.
Oh, constable knows, but he's bigger matters to attend. Besides, 'tis the season.
And with that gnomic pronouncement, he lifted the ugly iron knocker upon the door and struck the plate thrice. Hesitating a moment before turning to leave.
I'm sorry, sir, he muttered.
And then he trudged away into the thickening shadows.
Tune in tomorrow for the next part of The Vanishing Season.